Chapter 33. Now that Clive Durham was safe from intimacy, he looked forward to helping his friend, who must have had a pretty rough time since they parted in the smoking room. Their correspondence had ceased several months ago. Morris's last had been written after Birmingham, and announced he should not kill himself. Clive had never supposed he would, and was glad the melodrama was over. When they talked down the telephone, he heard a man whom he might respect at the other end of it, a fellow who sounded willing to let bygones be bygones and passion acquaintanceship. There was no affectation of ease. Poor Morris sounded shy, a bit huffy even, exactly the condition Clive deemed natural and felt he could ameliorate. He was anxious to do what he could. Though the quality of the past escaped him, he remembered its proportions and acknowledged that Morris had once lifted him out of aestheticism into the sun and wind of love. But for Morris, he would never have developed into being worthy of Anne. His friend had helped him through three barren years, and he would be ungrateful indeed if he did not help his friend. Clive did not like gratitude. He would rather have helped out of pure friendliness, but he had had to use the only tool he had, and if all went well, if Morris kept unemotional, if he remained at the end of a telephone, if he was sound as regarded Anne, if he was not bitter or too serious or too rough, then they might be friends again, though by a different route and in a different manner. Morris had admirable qualities, he knew this, and the time might be returning when he would feel it also. Such thoughts as the above occurred to Clive rarely and feebly. The centre of his life was Anne. Would Anne get on with his mother? Would Anne like Penge, she who had been brought up in Sussex near the sea? Would she regret the lack of religious opportunities there, and the presence of politics? Besotted with love, he gave her his body and soul. He poured out at her feet all that an earlier passion had taught him, and could only remember with an effort for whom that passion had been. In the first glow of his engagement, when she was the whole world to him, the Acropolis included, he thought of confessing to her about Morris. She had confessed a peccadillo to him, but loyalty to his friend withheld him, and he was glad afterwards, for, immortal as Anne proved, she was not Pallas Athene, and there were many points on which he could not touch. Their own union became the chief of these. When he arrived in her room after marriage, she did not know what he wanted. Despite an elaborate education, no one had told her about sex. Clive was as considerate as possible, but he scared her terribly and left feeling she hated him. She did not. She welcomed him on future nights, but it was always without a word. They united in a world that bore no reference to the daily, and this secrecy drew after it much else of their lives. So much could never be mentioned. He never saw her naked, nor she him. They ignored the reproductive and the digestive functions, so there would never be any question of this episode of his immaturity. It was unmentionable. It didn't stand between him and her. She stood between him and it. And on second thoughts he was glad, for though not disgraceful, it had been sentimental and deserved oblivion. Secrecy suited him. At least he adopted it without regret. He had never itched to call a spade a spade, and though he valued the body, the actual deed of sex seemed to him unimaginative and best veiled in night. Between men it is inexcusable, between man and woman it may be practiced, since nature and society approve, but never discussed nor vaunted. His ideal of marriage was temperate and graceful like all his ideals, and he found a fit helpmate in Anne, who had refinement herself and admired it in others. They loved each other tenderly. Beautiful conventions received them, while beyond the barrier, Morris wandered, the wrong words on his lips and the wrong desires in his heart, and his arms full of air.